Get the cheese to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
I don't know.
Hi, and welcome to Casual Trek, a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Ty and Deep Dark Holes. Come on in. So inviting here. I'm Charlie Etheridge, and I'm a writer, and I'm hanging out by the boulders with Alpha Shift.
And I'm Mars Reed Lobato, a science fiction writer, and I'm hiding behind the rock with Delta Shift.
Good luck with that one. So,
Delta Shifters.
Oh, dear. More trouble than they're worth. Anyway, each episode we watch stories from three different Star Trek shows and rank them on a big list of best to worst. And this episode, we're going to have a look at that favourite location in Star Trek, caves, for when you don't have a nearby quarry to film at, and you want it to be an alien world anyway. So, before we go on, Mars, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
So, Charlie, I recently reactivated my HBO Max subscription so I could watch Lazarus, the latest show from Cowboy Bebop director Shinichiro Watanabe. And I started watching the adult animated comedy drama Common Side Effects.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really good. It is about Marshall, who is a fungal specialist, who finds this blue mushroom, which when you take it, not only do you have incredibly psychedelic visions, but it will heal just about nearly anything, even up to the point of death. And of course, he wants to find a way to be able to produce this and get it out there, and Big Pharma don't want him to.
Of course.
I watched the first few episodes because I heard good things about it, and I was waiting for the moment when it was going to go full anti-vax propaganda, because when you have a show or story dealing with the pharmaceutical industry and Big Pharma, you are waiting for that. Well, you know, all vaccines cause autism or whatever. And it's like, no, it's not done that. It's kept the target like strictly at Big Pharma just basically pumping out drugs and drugs and drugs to becoming obscenely wealthy. The character designs are a bit weird. They look like if you try to make South Park character designs look like traditional 2D animation.
Weird.
So that's very off-putting. But on the whole, I've been really enjoying it. It's definitely, for an adult cartoon, it definitely is more into the drama than the comedy. But also, it's executive produced by Mike Judge, and he voiced a few of the characters. And you have a character who sounds like a dumber Hank Hill.
Wow. I've not heard of this at all.
Oh,
so yeah, I've no idea if it's available over here, but yeah, sounds interesting.
It's pretty good. The first season's only 10 episodes long, and the fact that I've watched 8 in the space of 2 weeks, given my notorious inability to watch television on a regular basis, should say a lot. Lazarus, yeah. The show I originally resubscribed to HBO Max for, I have yet to start watching.
Okay, wow.
So some things never change.
Yeah. Okay, keeping that up then, at least.
Yeah. So, Charlie, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying?
So, I have been playing Cyberpunk 2077. This was on offer, I think, while Emma and I were away on our anniversary, and she was right at the end of Dragon Age Veilguard, or mainly shouting at Dragon Age Veilguard for not being as good as she had hoped, just before we went away. So I was like, well, if I don't get time to play it, Emma will get some time to play it when she's done with Veilguard. And she had to be bullied into finishing Veilguard rather than just starting Cyberpunk. But I really loved Cyberpunk 2020, the role-playing game back in the day. I borrowed a friend's copy at sick form, and then they moved away, and I still have that copy. I've read Cyberpunk Red, the current iteration of the RPG, which feels painfully trad, but the video game, my word, it's been good fun. Night City is a huge teeming mess that keeps making me want to rewatch the 2012 Dread, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like, the apartment building your character, V, starts in, is exactly the buildings from like the blocks in Mega City 1 in that film. And it's bright, which I don't know, in my mind's eye running the RPG, it was always dark and dingy and neon and all that. But it's bright and weird. It can be funny at times. And one of the real joys I've found, and something I'll be mentioning in a blog post soon, is actually the joy of sharing the experience. As Emma started playing it with a V who was like formerly Corpo and has a very specific way of playing. And I'm a nomad V who is generally both a lot louder and a lot knifier than Emma's. And it's been such a joy just flinging knives into people and then shotgunning if they get too close, while Emma's been burning their brains with hacking. So it's been really fun seeing us both tackle a big game like this in quite different ways and just not stressing any spoilers or anything like that. So I'm sure I saw a YouTube video from someone about the finale anyway. So it's like, well, it's not like Alan Wake where Emma steals little moments to play Alan Wake 2 because I've not finished Alan Wake 1 yet.
No, I played some Cyberpunk 2077. I've enjoyed it. I know it had a very bad reputation on launch.
Oh, it was buggy as hell from what I gather. And even after that, the Xbox One and PS4 versions were apparently not good.
It's weird because we have the PS4 version and we've not had any problems with it.
Oh, good. Maybe it was just the Xbox One version.
Maybe. Yeah,
we would just, like, wait until we've got a bigger console.
It always seems to be, like, the games they always say are really buggy. I've never had any problems with. So, I don't know.
So, something else that we've not got any problems with is these three episodes of Star Trek. I mean, we might, but listen on, just in case. Our first episode of the evening is Star Trek, the original series, season 1, episode 26, titled The Devil in the Dark. This aired on the 9th of March, 1967. It was written by Gene L. Kuhn and directed by Joseph Pevney. The UK number one hit was Engelbert Humperdinck with Release Me, and the US had Rolling Stones with Ruby Tuesday, which is easily the clear winner out of these two.
Yeah.
Like, both have lasted longer than you'd think, really. Like, Ruby Tuesday was one where I didn't realise it was that. I was like, oh!
No.
Oh, it's you! Yeah, that's good.
The trouble with Ruby Tuesday, it has the same kind of tune line as Goodnight, as Goodbye Blue Sky from The Wall.
Yeah.
And so I hear that kind of that tune, I'm immediately going to go to The Wall.
Yeah. So, yeah, this one, I remember, like, seeing on the list and going, oh, this is the one episode of the original series that I saw all the way through before Casual Trek, and it's not. So, yeah.
Do you remember what episode that is, though?
One with weird-looking jellyfish egg things, like, on a ceiling, possibly.
Okay, I think I know what episode that is.
Yeah, you can see it stuck with me.
Yeah, I think it's Operation Annihilate, which is the one where Sam Kirk turns up only to be immediately dead, and it's Shatner in a fake tash.
Ah, good. Okay. So yeah, one day we'll watch that, and then I will have seen no more episodes of the original series than what we've covered in Casual Trek.
Okay.
But for now, we're dancing in the dark with a devil in the dark.
Okay, Bruce. All right. Okay, you got your best Levi's? You got your best Levi's on?
I mean, they're not great, but yeah.
All right, fantastic. Okay, get in the cave and dance away.
So, we get a suspenseful zoom into a planet, and then into a mine, and then caves! Yes, a group of jumpsuited men work in the mines normally, but some kind of monsters killed 50 of them. The Enterprise is on its way. But will the lads live that long? Well, one of them won't, as he's caught alone and burnt to a crisp. Oh no! The Enterprise rocks up to Janus 6, and our core trio beam down to check what's up. Mr. Vandenberg explained to her this planet's great for mining, it's full of resources, but also a monster. He pulls out a kind of OSR cave map to show where the corpses were found. And a guy in a pink jumpsuit called Ed Apple saw a glimpse of something shaggy and shot it, but it ran away. All while this is going on, Spock's admiring a silicon ball. Apparently they're all over the place and destroyed or disregarded. Another miner wanders into the caves and dies, but this time there's a hole going into the pump room. The monsters manage to nick an essential pump, which is going to wreck life support. Scotty gets asked, you know, do we have a mining colony pump anywhere, and scoffs at this. But he can jury-rig one that will last for maybe 48 hours, and that'll have to do. Spock posits that the life form might be silicon-based, and Kirk backs this up, as yeah, they've had previous with that sort of thing. Any armour plating would also work against Phaser 1, which is what the miners have, compared to Phaser 2, which the Enterprise has. They keep saying Phaser 1 and Phaser 2, and don't really define what the difference is between them, aside from the number. Anyway.
Well, you know, you have Gun 1, yep, which shoot bullet, and yep, you have Gun 2, which shoot bull. I see your point.
Yeah. Spock is still contemplating the silicon orbs, but he's not going to commit to anything yet. Kirk summons a bunch of red shirts and doesn't want any more deaths. Oh no, one of them immediately goes off alone and dies. They really should have, like, tied
buddy, up with buddy string system.
Buddy system. Kirk and Spock are following the buddy system. They find a burning tunnel and, oh my god, they've found a quivering magma vomit-looking thing. They shoot it, and it races off. And luckily, there's a very prop-looking bit of it that fell off. It can be hurt, and it's kind of pulsing weirdly. Still, inform the men. Spock's sensors show there's just one of them, and if it's the last of its kind, it'd be unethical to murder it. Kirk is currently on Team Murder, though, for this one. Scotty calls in, says, oh, the pump's fucked. And Kirk wants to send the miners away, but they want to get stuck in with the violence, with clubs if necessary, which is incredibly worse than even Phaser 1. Kirk and Spock go it alone, and then split off when a tunnel bisects. And, Kirk finds some silicon balls, and the monster, and the cave-in! He's alright, he's just a bit trapped. And he pulls his phaser out and hesitates when the creature recoils. Spock says to kill it, and Kirk's changed sides now, deciding to try talking to us instead. When Spock gets in, he tries a mind meld, and all that results in is PAIN! Spock mentions that it's called the Horta. It's smart, but it's hurting. It's got a really bad injury on its bum, which it does show to them. And it burns the words, no kill I, into the ground. Idiot Horta. They need to win its confidence. They need to summon Bones to help. And he gives the now classic line, I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer. Because he's trying to heal a mostly rock monster. Kirk's guided to the nest where there are a bunch of these orbs. Actually, eggs, I guess, are shattered. Also, the pump that the Horta somehow, with no opposable limbs, stole. Vandenberg and his lads are looking unruly. They're definitely out for blood in proper vicious mob mode. Spock says the Horta's dying, and Bones gets really ratty up with some folks on the Enterprise for supplies. When Vandenberg and his lads show up, Arlott explained the Horta was fine until her eggs were harmed. Thousands of her offspring have been killed by the miners, and Kirk suggests maybe get along peacefully by having the Horta hatch, and then do their inoffensive tunnelling so humans can kind of scurry along picking up their leavings afterwards. And that only works if the Horta's alive. Luckily, Bones has sealed it in with some cement, so I guess he is actually a bricklayer now. They leave, having brokered peace between carbon and silicon life forms.
Can I just say, Charlie, I have to commend you, because if I had written a recap for this episode, I would never shut up about Spock contemplating the balls.
He loves contemplating those orbs.
He likes inspecting those big, shiny balls. Spock is very intrigued by big balls.
He does like the big balls.
All right, okay. So, and finish.
So, Bones tries to joke about Spock's ears, but Spock mentions that Vahorta fancied him the most because of them. How very modest of him.
And that's another trip to HR for Bones at 12 minutes. At 12 seconds.
Okay. Wow. Oh, I was, oh. 12 minutes. I was wondering where the time went.
So, is this one of the few occurrences where early Spock calls Kirk Jim when he's not high on some sort of space spore or emotionally impaired?
And this is what? This is one of the last episodes of the first season, so maybe he's letting his hair down slightly.
I did notice that, you know, the moment Kirk's in danger, he is all about the gym.
Yeah, well, maybe it's just letting that emotional side come out as little as it is. Yeah, it was, while we didn't get to see much for crew here outside for Core 3, this had a fun bit of intrigue and horror of trying to find what was doing all these murders. And oh my god, the creature. That Horta, like, you could see, I hope the person playing it was enjoying themselves.
I'd like to think that they did. You know, a lot of it kind of blah, blah,
blah, blah. A lot of weird shaking for something that looks like it's stone and magma. Like, you wouldn't expect one of those giant, what are the names of them? Giant rock beasts from Zelda to kind of shake and shimmy.
Yeah. I can't remember. Oh, the Gorons.
Yes. Well, not even them. Like, the ones that are literally just big moving rock. This is kind of like the magma one of them.
Gotcha. I don't know.
It would be Impedance Corner.
Oh, yes. You know, the Hort was a fantastic design, even if at times it looks like a microwavable pizza I particularly burnt.
Yeah. I was thinking it was a I think I wrote on my notes, it looked like a particularly heinous sick. I've had a few, mainly after Strawberry Daiquiri Night went way too far, and I was just throwing up red after that. But yeah, this looks like someone's had a really rough meal, a lot of alcohol to wash it down, and it's come back up vicious.
Yep.
Mm.
Oh.
So yeah, I loved that. Yeah, that look yep. of it.
This was a lot of fun. Like, yeah. I think this is one of the TOS, like, when I felt like watching an episode, it's just like, yeah, I'm going to watch this one. It's a nice little self-contained story, got some good acting, got caves. Spock, very curious, Spock's doing a lot of thinking outside the box this one.
Yeah, I get the intent of having a bit of suspense of like, oh no, the balls are eggs, actually. But yeah, normally I'd expect him to be a bit more open with his hypothesis than going, well, obviously this is silicon, and that means, you know, if that's a silicon-based life form, these aren't just manifested here. These aren't its leavings. These are its offspring, which apparently only one survives long enough to hatch and train all the others. It's a weird life as a Horta.
Yeah, I get the feeling that after McCoy was just making fun of him, Spock was like, you know what? Fuck you. I'm not saying anything.
Yeah. So, given the eggs were apparently bouncy balls painted gold, do you think these might have had any influence on the Marvel Comics character Gold Balls?
We can only hope.
We can indeed. Yeah, like, it's been a while since I've read any comics with Gold Balls in, but I'm hoping that on his first appearance, we just catch in the background he was watching this and was like, hang on, I make these balls made of gold, which are also weirdly eggs.
Eggs.
Yeah.
That's just Jonathan Hickman putting more thought into gold balls than Brian Michael Bendis ever did.
Oh, yes. And yeah, looking at the notes here, apparently Shatner's father passed away during filming here. And he kept filming for the initial stuff, but a stand-in took over for reshoots. I did not notice that at all.
No.
Which might be a kind of, yeah, that's a good sign from the episode itself. And this is one where I wasn't actually on a train watching it on a tiny screen. It was nice, big TV job for this one.
Believe me, normally with this show, when it cuts to their stunt double or a stand-in, you can tell.
Oh, God, yeah. Yes, also, another thing is, this is the only episode that has no speaking parts for women. which, yeah, here's for one that you want, weird sexists. So there you go. It's the only one you got.
I mean, you know, do we count No Kill Eye as dialogue? I mean, is the Horta is
The Horta is female.
The Horta is female. Spock genders the Horta straight away.
I hope that's a consensual gendering from Spock. Yeah, I admit I was in hysterics when I saw the No Kill Eye. It felt very unnecessary. It's like, we get it, Horta.
We get it.
How have you learned to write in English?
Clearly from the mind meld.
Apparently so. Not Vulcan, though.
No, I mean, given that Spock goes into, like, Horta beat poetry.
Oh, I tried listing some of those lines off and couldn't. It was, yeah, there was some good weird bits from there, which pretty much still mostly go to pain.
And, the pain!
And yes, their Chamber of Tomorrows and things, which were destroyed when they're like, oh yeah, the pump, which it's somehow acquired.
Yeah.
Like, maybe it's just all hands underneath the kind of weird goopy mess.
Were you expecting Kirk to accidentally just step into a Horta egg as he's climbing through the cave? I was waiting for the moment where it's just like, crunch. Shit.
I mean, maybe that was done off screen and it just brush it away, going, look, they've killed thousands. It's sad, but one more, you know. It's not the end of the world.
Weird unintentional colonialism here, where the settlers go, oh, hey, we found an intelligent species to whom this planet is native. Let's make them do our job for us and get incredibly rich.
I mean, both of them, it seems to have been an agreement for Horta has come to with them. Admittedly, possibly in the leave my offspring alone, you fuckers kind of way. So it may not be the best agreement that's been reached there, but good news is there's thousands of Horta. They can at least burn the miners if they need to.
I think I seem to recall from one of the Star Trek novels I have read, like the handful I've read, one of the Horta babies actually joins Starfleet and is sent to the Enterprise.
How does it exist?
I don't know. I assume, like,
to have a suit?
Rocks? I don't know. Because, like, maybe the burning is something that it doesn't do naturally. Like, it secretes something.
Yeah, maybe. Because Spock actually has to touch it at one point.
Spock touches it, and he seems, for the most part, fine.
Yeah, no different than normal.
Yeah, like, it's not burning through the floor.
Yeah.
So, and it can burn No Kill Eye in the floor. So clearly, the Horta can turn it off.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine it in a Starfleet uniform now, and it's a weird visual. Fans of the show, if anyone wants to send in a picture of it, then...
I remember that the Horta tells McCoy that its mother sends its regards.
Aww.
And I do actually have a DS9 book somewhere in the Doom pile where a bunch of Horta eggs go missing because they were going to get sent to a mine on Bajor. And they get lost somewhere in Deep Space Nine, and shenanigans ensue. Hang on.
God, I had no idea there was so much Horta material out there.
Do you know how many Star Trek novels you can find in any secondhand bookshop? They, no pun intended, mined everything.
Of course.
Hang on a second. I mean, at least it's not one of the many, many TOS novels, which is someone's very clearly edited Kirk Spock slash fiction.
Oh, dear.
Okay, here we go. Devil in the Sky. Commander Sisko must face a horde of hungry aliens consuming Deep Space Nine, trademark, from within.
Oh.
Written by Greg Cox and John Gregory Betancourt. The horses of Janus VI are the greatest miners in the galaxy, capable of burning through solid rock the way humanoids move through air. Recruited to help rebuild Bajor's devastated mining industry, the horses could provide new hope for the planet's struggling economy. But when Cardassian raiders abducted the mother Horta, Commander Sisko finds himself stuck with 20 Horta eggs, and then the eggs begin to hatch. While Major Kira leads a desperate rescue mission deep into Cardassian space, Commander Sisko faces a ravaging mass of newborn Hortas, uncontrollable, indestructible, and eager to consume Deep Space Nine, trademark, itself.
Oh my god.
You know what, I'm actually going to pop that right there, and I might actually start that tonight. That sounds kind of fun.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. I'm just seeing on Memory Beta, there definitely are images of Starfleet Hoarder. Okay, good.
But good. Yeah, you know, good. Like, you know, we don't get to see non-humanoid races a lot in Star Trek because money. But usually when we have, they've tended to be pretty impressive.
Yeah. So, speaking of pretty impressive, we have a big list of best to worst Star Trek episodes and films, going 159 entries long.
One last thing. Is this the first time we get the "I'm a doctor, not a blank, blank, blank" catchphrase, or have we had it before?
I'm sure we've experienced it before, but we're experiencing Star Trek in non-linear time, so I genuinely don't know.
Like a wormhole alien.
Yeah, that's the excuse I'll use.
Yeah, it's more fun that way.
Yeah, anyway, a big list, 159 entries long. Our number one spot is Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Coming in at number 50, we have Star Trek The Next Generation with I, Borg. Then at number 100, we have some stormy weather for Discovery. And finally, down at the bottom in the garbage, we have Star Trek : Section 31.
Emphasis on the colon.
Yeah, so where do we put this devil in the dark?
Ooh, okay. It's not top 10. Even though it's a really good episode, it's definitely up there.
Yeah, it's good, but not groundbreaking.
Like, okay, let's have a look. We've got number 15. TOS, which is Mirror Mirror.
Yeah. See, I was looking a bit further down and wondering, because, yeah, it's not better than Conscience of the King, which, well, this is a fun creature that has, you know, the creature that is man.
All right. Okay. Number 25, we have TNG's Preemptive Strike.
Oh, that's so good.
Number 26, we have TNG's The Drumhead.
Yeah. Again, yeah, we've got a fun creature feature, and we're looking at a lot of these very human drama kind of things here. Yeah.
This is what makes Doctor Who easier to kind of rank and review at times, because, hey, which is this one? Oh, it's Ice Warriors attacking a base under siege. Okay, what's this one? It's the Cybermen attacking a base under siege. What's that one? Giant maggots. Right, good, go.
Well, I mean, again, we got a giant weird vomit-looking monster thing.
Giant burnt pizza.
Oh, God. The first time that I used an oven that had a grill inside rather than a separate grill, I managed to accidentally grill a pizza. And yeah, it didn't look a million miles away from this.
Right. Number 30.
Yeah.
Strange New Worlds, Children of the Comet.
I think I prefer Children of the Comet.
Okay.
Just below it, we've got The Hope That Is You, Part 1, which is good, but I don't think as good.
No. And again, like, I could put on Devil in the Dark anytime. I've watched it in the last week, and I can still just put it on and go, man, this is fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, with Discovery, which is a big problem I have a lot of the kind of this HBO prestige TV drama era of TV, it's really hard to just kind of put on a random episode and just kind of chill. It's like, I can't just put on a random episode of Discovery and chill. It would be like, right, I have to start the season because you've got all the plot lines and plot threads going.
I enjoyed The Hope That Is You. It's spot number 31 here, after all. But yep. Children of the Comet, I have seen independently of the season, of the show. You know, I've watched it when I've wanted to watch it, and it doesn't really need anything else ahead of time.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So, put this down as our new 31.
Yeah, that sounds good. So, our second episode of the evening is Star Trek The Next Generation, Season 4, Episode 9, titled Final Mission. It aired on the 19th of November, 1990, teleplay by Casey Arnold Ince and Jerry Taylor. I think it's possibly our last Jerry Taylor story by Casey Arnold-Ince and directed by Corey Allen. The UK number one hit was The Righteous Brothers with Unchained Melody, and the US was Mariah Carey with Love Takes Time. I didn't really care for either of these.
It took me a while. The Righteous Brothers song started playing, I was like, this sounds a very much a throwback to the 50s. Then I did some research, like, oh, this Ghost was the film that was really popular this year.
Yeah.
Because this is the song from the one scene from Ghost that everyone remembers.
Yeah, you know the one. You're probably picturing the one.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I said, it's probably the one on the VHS cover for Ghost. I can't remember.
Probably. Yeah, I mostly just remember Robson and Jerome covering it, which, yeah, is, again, another sign of my old age. And yeah, for Mariah Carey was not... It felt like it's not her at her full power yet.
No.
By full power, I mean belting it out. And yeah, horrifying people when they're having to work at Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although it is nice to hear a Mariah Carey song, which isn't that one.
Yes, that is good.
Although so... the way you made it sound like she's not yet at full power made her sound like she's a character in like the latter half of Dragon Ball Z. When a lot of the stories are basically characters powering up to fight, because if Goku turns up early, fight's done, so they have to kind of draw out Goku being dead, incapacitated in space, dead to ludicrous degrees to make sure there's a story going.
He does die at a Marvel Comics rate.
Definitely. Yeah.
Right, and we have a new cave situation here. So, Miles, you have 5 minutes or you will be stuck in a cave with a boy. Starting now.
Okay, Prince Andrew. Picard has to go settle a mining dispute via shuttlecraft, but first, he summons Wesley for personal matters. Wesley arrives 10 minutes late, claiming he was working on an important experiment. Translation, he was jacking it.
Yeah.
With some very volatile chemicals. Translation, he was trying butt stuff. Oh, Wesley finally made it to Starfleet Academy when a spot opened up in Nearseer's class. Translation, oh boy, we're not going there. With 2 weeks to go. Picard has Wesley accompany him on the mission, while the Enterprise has to go help some trouble on Gamelon 5. Riker in charge. The miners sent a shuttle, a clapped-out rig piloted by not Space 1999 Ace Eagle pilot Alan Carter, but Captain Durgo, who has some forehead growths. The three leave, and the Enterprise heads off, so if anything bad happens to the shuttle, there's no one there to help, and the shuttle immediately crashes on the nearest Class M moon with strong magnetic interference. Oh, we're actually seeing some crashing model work, although Red Dwarf would have showed the shuttle actually crashing into the planet. The three work to salvage what they can from the shuttle while they work to find shelter from the heat. It's one of those desert moon dealies. Unfortunately, while the shuttle has medical supplies, there's no emergency food and water since the replicator was damaged. Picard immediately looks at Wesley Crusher and sees a cooked chicken, cartoon style. Meanwhile, in the B-plot, the Enterprise reaches Gamelon 5 and finds that the mysterious ship that's contaminating the planet is actually an ancient garbage barge leaking dangerous chemicals into the planetary atmosphere. Riker wants to track the beam the ship into the nearby sun, but Geordi is worried that if they get too close, the Enterprise will be contaminated by the radiation as well, and wants to attach some thruster units to it instead, and just kind of drive it like a JATO rocket car, like in that one episode of Mythbusters. They get a call from the miners that the shuttle hasn't arrived, and can they go look for them? Riker tells them that they have to wait until the garbage barge is disposed of. Beverly Crusher looks worried. This will probably be what she's doing for the whole episode. Now in their worst and most culturally offensive emergency toy bins, Picard, Wesley, and Durgo plan to head off to nearby mountains. Durgo immediately pulls a gun at Picard, and Wesley tries his best tough guy act. Picard talks Durgo down and the three head off, walking without rhythm so they won't attract the worm. Walk without rhythm and they won't attract the worm. Ooh, Durgo has a sneaky bottle of booze that he's not sharing. Wesley has located a repeating energy pattern on the tricorder coming from the mountains. Maybe some kind of electromagnetic properties in the rock, or some kind of life form. Too far to go back, the three have no choice but to keep going. Upon reaching a mountain cave with some nice usable stairs, Durgo hopes for water, and Wes discovers that the signal has changed. Oh, and Durgo's booze gets discovered, and Picard pockets it. It could be more useful as a coolant. Meanwhile, back on the Enterprise, Dr. Crusher is prepping her medical team to help the people on Gamelon 5. Troy comes in with some bad news. The nearest ship who can help is a week away, and Crusher is going to drown herself in her work so she doesn't freak out about Wesley. Geordi has attached the thrusters to the garbage barge, but all it does is actually damage the barge more, and now they have no choice but to tractor beam the barge themselves, risking radioactive contamination on the Enterprise. Deep in the caves, they find water! Great! But the water's trapped behind a force field. Not great! Durgo fires his phase with the force field, and energy being rushes out of the caves and causes a cave-in. Wesley's about to get squished, but Picard pushes him out of the way and gets caught and gravely wounded in the rock fall of about 5 to 10 tennis ball-sized rocks, fracturing his arm, breaking his leg, and more than likely a really bad concussion. Durgo thinks there's probably internal bleeding and that Picard won't survive. Wesley tries to comfort Picard, but Picard tells Wesley that he's going to get worse and that he needs to be able to stand up to Durgo himself. Radiation levels on the Enterprise are getting worse. The non-essential crew is sheltering deep in the ship, but they need to go faster or else the poisoning is going to get worse. Geordi tries to increase the speed, but it's causing the tractor beam to destabilize, and there's no choice but to enhance the power of the fusion reactors, because that radiation is going to get fatal in about 35 minutes. Back in the cave, the energy creature has webbed Durgo's phaser up, like Spider-Man!
Oh no! It's 5 minutes. What a phrase to end that with.
Back in the cave, the energy creature has webbed Durgo's phaser up, like Spider-Man! Wesley theorizes that the closer they get to the water, the energy readings rise in the creature, some kind of sentry, will react. Wesley needs to find a way to manipulate the energy readings so that they can control the sentry. Durgo wants to start blasting. Wesley wants to apply the scientific method, but Durgo just goes ahead and starts blasting. Wesley sets his phaser on automatic, the creature arrives, but instead of going for Wesley's phaser, which was on maximum, it goes for Durgo, killing him straight away. Well, guess you don't need to learn how to grow a backbone, Wesley. Mm-hmm. On the Enterprise, it's not going well. They've boosted fusion reactors to increase their speed, and with just seconds to spare, they're able to shoot the barge into the sun. It's getting cold in them caves. Wesley heats up some rocks with his phaser. Wesley apologizes about not standing up to Durgo, but Picard passes out. Wesley tries to keep Picard awake and alive by telling him about the good old times. You remember when he told me to shut up, Wesley? Good old times. Telling him about a time when Picard opened up to him. Picard regrets bringing Wesley along, doing it because he was worried that he wouldn't see Wesley again. You know, it's not like all of Wesley's friends are on the Enterprise, and his mother's there as well. Wesley tells him that he's lived more in the last 3 years than some people do in a lifetime, and he was lucky to serve with Picard. Wesley admits that everything he ever did was all to make Picard proud of him, and damn it, he's learned not to quit, so don't you quit on dying me, Jean-Luc Picard, and Wesley won't let him. The Enterprise is now able to search for the shuttle. They found a debris and have set a course to search one of the moons. Back in the cave, Picard is muttering to himself deliriously as Wesley works, forgetting where they are. Wesley has an idea. Picard doesn't think he's gonna make it. But he has so much he wants to tell Wesley about the Academy, including Boothby, the groundskeeper. Picard envies Wesley being at the beginning of the adventure as Picard readies himself for death. Except, no, telling Wesley that he was always proud of him. Except for the shut up Wesley moment. Wesley has taken his communicator and has jerry-rigged himself a way to control the sentry. Wesley succeeds and is able to get the water needed to keep both of them alive until the Enterprise finally comes and rescues them. Picard asks Wesley why he's in such a dirty uniform, and Wesley tells Picard that he's not looking so great himself. Picard shakes Wesley's hand and tells him that he'll be missed, because, well, I guess Wesley's spending the next 2 weeks in solitary confinement for dirty uniform. I don't know.
Probably. Wow, that's 2 minutes and 55 seconds. So, Miles, like me, you are painfully British.
Yes.
Yeah. I could feel when Picard was saying about being proud of Wesley, he could not have said that unless he was on his deathbed.
Pretty much.
Yeah, and I had that feeling of, oh no, about myself with that. It's like, shit. Okay. Yeah, I didn't know whether you had similar feelings of relating far too much to
Yeah, there is very much that kind of like, you know, okay, you know, men can only admit their feelings when, I don't know, they're on their deathbed or they're about to die or, you know, they're stuck in a cave with Will Wheaton.
Yeah, and I loved Nick Tate in it. He was very good fun. Proper weasel energy going on. And, you know, I always like a good weasel. Do you reckon Picard took a sneaky nip or two from that booze that he
stole? Oh, come on. Picard, no. Patrick Stewart definitely would have.
Yes. Yeah, apparently that was inspired by Shackleton doing the same sort of thing. But yeah, here with this coward, with Nick Tate's character, it was like, yep, every single time he'll make the worst decision. He will do terrible things. It's like, good, good work.
This needless scene where Picard takes a swig of the booze and just goes to Wesley and goes, drink this, boy. It'll put hairs on your chest.
Exactly. Yeah, this was one of those ones where it felt like the challenge wasn't as much of a thing as, you know, the character interactions in the cave between Wesley, Picard, and Nick Tate, who I admit, in my notes, I only ever referred to as Nick Tate.
Nick Tate, okay.
Of course.
I feel the episode missed a trick by having Wesley's conflict not be standing up for himself against Durgo, and to have it be yet another Wesley solves a problem using his intelligence, which is how Wesley Crusher solves 90% of the problems in a Wesley Crusher story.
Yeah, yeah, that is... I get killing Nick Tate in there, but yeah, if he'd been able to go, no, Picard's helpless, but I'm going to take charge now, I'm a grown-up too, then yeah... Maybe that would have been a bit more effective.
Because this is Wesley effectively being written out of the show, apart from his once a year contractual reappearance.
Yeah.
Which I think we've covered one, because it's the game, craptacular as it is, but still so much fun.
Yeah, that one's good fun. I don't know, this one was entertaining, but I think it's probably our weaker of the evening.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not that Will Wheaton is bad at this. It's just, you know, Wesley is still a bit wet in general as far as writing.
I was actually thinking about this this last week. It feels like season one, they try and do more. They feature Wesley a lot more.
Hmm.
Probably because, you know, I guess he's the kid viewpoint character, but either just they responded to the negative reactions to the character, or they just had no idea how to write him in a decent way that he kind of gets sidetracked. It feels like he gets sidetracked from like season two onwards.
Yeah, it definitely has that vibe to it of, if they don't know what to do, so they're going to leave him alone. Maybe they'll have him in the background or... you know, kind of just on the bridge, manning the con. But yeah, it's kind of a shame, but...
It's definitely a shame because, you know, Will Wheaton is a good actor. You know, he's great in Stand By Me and other stuff. You can see why Roddenberry would try and snap him up for Star Trek. It is that thing of, you have a character who is definitely trying to be the viewpoint character and the audience hates him.
Yeah.
And it's like Adric from Doctor Who, who was also an irritating little genius, mm-hmm. who was originally kind of written to be more like an Artful Dodger kind of, you know, sneaky, sly scamp. But that interesting part of his character goes away pretty quickly, and that kind of mentor-mentee relationship works better with the much older Tom Baker. But when Tom Baker leaves and becomes the much younger Peter Davidson, Adric gets relegated to snotty, overly intelligent kid brother, and thus dies in a horrific space shuttle accident.
Right. Wesley
survived the space shuttle accident.
Yes, he did. Yeah, that kind of thing does feel odd and a bit like a changing lead actor to play off of, and changing creative teams and that is going to really shake it up. With here, you know, the creative teams we're getting at this point, most of them aren't people that were around on season one.
Yeah.
And a lot of the reception to Wesley in season one was terrible. So I get the kind of, no, just let him go.
Let's let him go. And like, you know, Wheaton has spoken about his frustration with the role and just Star Trek and at the time.
Mm.
And wants to do a movie career, which sadly never really panned out.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think they could have done something with Wesley Crusher. Just like they couldn't, no one could be asked, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, this episode feels like, while it is intended as a nice send-off, and for Picard to go from, you know, oh, I hate children, to I respect you, but only on my deathbed. If anyone asks, I never said any of this. It feels more, I don't know, servicing that need than telling a great story.
It would have been nice to have him, like, have a goodbye with the characters like Geordi or Data or Riker, who clearly spend more time with Wesley off shift than Picard, or even with Crusher.
Yeah. Yeah, with any of that lot, because, yeah, the little nerd got on well with, especially with, like, Geordi and Data.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Oh, well. Never mind.
Never mind.
So, I guess it's more a case of looking for something a little middling.
Yeah.
I'll say that. This is a top-heavy list, so I immediately saw Cat's Paw, which is at 120, and I would much rather watch Cat's Paw.
Yeah, like, this one, it's okay. The trouble is with Star Trek, it very rarely do we get episodes which are absolute train wrecks, especially with TNG. And usually it's going to be something like, oh, this is the really racist one.
Yeah. Oh my god, one day we're going to have to do that.
Or the Quark has a sex change operation, or the Trip gets pregnant episode.
Oh yeah. I mean, we can probably do a whole episode on mystical pregnancies.
Oh god. So, like, this one's crime is, this is episode 9 out of, like, 22, 23. It's not all going to be perfect. And this one, I think it's all there. I just think the focus wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all there. Unfortunately, the it, the all, and the there aren't great.
The B plot is serviceable. It's an excuse to get the crew away, to get the rest of the crew away. But, like, you know, imagine if this episode had just been, like, a two-hander with Picard and Wesley.
Mm.
Like, you could have potentially had, like, something really dramatic.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the problem with science fiction is that you can't have your science fiction story be a two-hander between the captain and, like, the young child who looks up to him and has come to mean so much to him. And you can't just have a two-handed drama. You had to have some actual plot and some sci-fi stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like those two-hander episodes of EastEnders where you go, yep, someone arrives in someone's kitchen, so oh, put the kettle on, and then you've got 30 minutes of tense arguing.
Or just like the one episode of Only Fools and Horses where Del Boy gets his hand on a bomb shelter and 20 minutes of the episode, or actually no, to bring up Red Dwarf, which I referred to earlier, which is the episode Marooned, when Lister and Rimmer are marooned on an ice planet, and it's just them for 20 minutes.
Oh, that is a...
Talking about how they lost their virginity, or just, like, them just trying to keep each other going in this terrible situation, and, like, that's amazing. Okay, there's the science fiction stuff of how they got on the planet, but most of it is basically a comedy drama between the two people who hate each other the most, just trying to survive.
Yeah, I mean, with this, maybe if Durgo was a more interesting kind of foil and third party in it, then that would have been stuff to play off. But yeah.
It's like, you know, Picard's like, oh, Wesley, you have to stand up to Durgo. And you're like, okay, and Durgo dies in 5 minutes.
Yeah. That said, at least Nick Tate enjoyed it enough to appear in DS9.
Yeah.
And he was great in that.
Like, he's really good at being a lovable arse.
Yes.
Unlike in Space 1999, where he plays, like, I would say, a square-jawed type who just wants to leave.
Yeah. Yes, every opportunity that we've seen so far. Okay, so definitely under Cat's Paw, which is 120. We do have, oh god, actually, yeah, we've got Space Seed a little further than that.
Speak
123,
okay,
with
more blackface. At 124, yeah, we have some more surrogate fathers and sons with the Changeling, where Kirk adopts a powerful space probe as his metal son.
Yeah, I don't know, I think I prefer the metal probe.
Yeah.
Like, again, I've nothing against Will Wheaton the man, but the metal probe for me.
Wesley just doesn't work.
Okay, Beyond the Farthest Star, the first one of the animated series with the big alien ship, and...
Okay, underneath that, at 126...
Oh, God.
We got to do it, even though my voice might not hold up through it, on the count of three.
Yep.
One, two, three. Alamo Red Rain! Move along home!
That's definitely better. 100%. Okay, Space Amoeba. Oh, shit. Like the Space Amoeba. Impossible Box. It's actually some good drama.
Yeah. Let's Sleep in Borg, number 129, which is Let's Sleep in Borg Lie, which is the Prodigy Borg episode. Fantastic use of the Borg.
Yeah, good use of Borg, good use of Zero being part of a hive mind and how that interacts.
Okay, look down at 135.
Oh, hello. We've got Justice.
Which is, what's the episode about?
It's about Wesley ruining the trip to Planet Fuck.
Okay, which episode is better? Wesley ruining a trip to Planet Fuck, or Wesley Crusher does one last mission?
I mean, I have to tell you the truth about this, because I'm in Starfleet, and they don't lie. Yeah, Justice is better.
Okay, I think that calls it.
Okay. Wow, so what is our 136th entry here? Oh, good.
And on the off chance that Will Wheaton ever listens to this, which I doubt, but Will, we love you.
Yeah, and you know, when winter comes, kind of want one of those terrible Wesley Crusher sweaters.
Yeah, they look so cozy.
They do. They do. Yeah, our third episode is Star Trek Lower Decks, Season 4, Episode 8, simply titled Caves. And it proved as the inspiration for this entire episode, given its subject matter. It aired on the 19th of October, 2023, written by Ben Rogers, directed by Megan Lloyd. The UK number one hit was Kenya Grace with Strangers, and the US with Doja Cat's Paint the Town Red. Strangers left my head almost as soon as I stopped playing.
Yeah.
And Paint Town Red, it's one of those tricky things of going, it is just making me think of what it's sampling, really. But yeah, it's fine. I don't know if I've actually heard much Doja before this. But yeah, it's all right.
I have to agree. All right. Okay, so animated.
Three minutes.
I think, or was it 2.5 minutes?
I can't remember. Either way, go right, for
I'll
it.
I'll give you 3 minutes.
Sadly, we do not have the the Legion of Superheroes charter, kind of equivalent for Casual Trek.
I'm with the Legion of Superheroes. We don't lie.
I mean, they do. They lie. They mostly prank Superboy in those early years and make him cry a lot.
Lie, cheat, steal.
Okay, anyway.
Right, okay, so, you have 3 minutes to talk about Caves.
So, the gang are back together. Boimler, Mariner, Rutherford and Tendi have been away from each other for a little bit, and they're very excited until they find out it's a mission to go and examine some moss in a cave. Mariner despairs at this, but Rumford and Tendi love it, the big nerds. Then there's a cave-in, and the moss starts glowing, and it's growing, and it eats one of Tendi's shoes, the freak. How do they get out of this? Well, while they put things together, they're going to have a flashback episode, because caves happen a lot in the Star Trek universe. So, Tendi does keep trying to bring up when they all got stuck in a turbo lift and told that's not relevant, that's a lift, not a cave. Boimler's flashback is on Chiron 4, when he was stuck in a cave with Steve Levy, a conspiracy theorist who keeps blaming everything on Vendorian shapeshifters. Levy causes a cave-in, and Boimler has a go at him for his terrible theories. No, Wolf 359 was not an inside job. Yes, Q exists. And no, Picard's not a hologram. This annoys the Vendorians, who are real and are testing them. They've failed the friendship test, but when they find out Levy's a big fan of theirs, they have a nice meal of bugs before going on their way, and Boimler is still friends with Levy now, disgusting everyone else in the present. Rutherford's flashback is on Balkus 9, when he and T'Ana got stuck in a cave after their alien guide died when a giant Graflax attacked them. The guide touches Rutherford, impregnating him with her clone. The birth is thankfully a caesarean, and he alternates between scouting and raising the baby with Dr. T'Ana. She's not as keen on being a parent, but comes to like him. The baby, that is. Graflax watches this, and when Rutherford gets his tricorder to translate, turns out it's also a parent. It helps guide them out, and everyone's shocked that he never told them he was pregnant. Mariner's flashback is on Glish, where she crashed with Delta Ship for shift, the loathed night shift. They need some Purgium to fix the shuttle, but the closer they get, the older they get. Asif's broken his leg in the crash, and he's the youngest, so he's goaded into hopping over towards it, getting worse and worse, even losing his leg horribly. An old Caravitas and Mariner finally talk over their differences, which mostly boil down to their shift work patterns. While this happens, Amadou finds some Purgium, which makes him younger, and that's a lot less horrifying to go near. They can leave, but Asif still lost his leg. Mariner is now friends with Delta Shift. The group all bicker about how they've grown apart as the predatory moss closes in, and Tendi brings up her flashback. It's just after the pilot episode, and the group were drunk, stuck in a turbo lift, and had a nice bit of a chat, played some games of throwing stuff at Boimler, and then crashed out as one happy little group. It was a nice time. Chats burst through.
Sorry.
That's right, you've just burst through in the style of Shax. So,
right. That's fine. Okay, timer set and go.
Shax bursts through to rescue them. The moss is touched by this story. Oh yes, the moss is self-aware. It wants some more stories and will even let them live. If anything, it's flattered by the scanning that's going on. Some nearby rocks shapeshift over into the forms of those Vendorians. All those scamps. Yes, this was another test and helped show the group's enduring friendship. Aww.
Aww. 32 seconds.
Okay. Yeah, I gather the Vendorians are actually a thing.
Yeah, I think they turn up in the animated series.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, they look very much like they couldn't have been done on a regular Star Trek budget. But yeah, I like these kind of fake clip episode type things with this, and yeah, it still manages to ride that line of lovingly ribbing Star Trek by going on about how the caves all look the same. They'll have weirdly flat floors as if you need to move dollies around on it and stuff like that, in a way that likes all of that rather than going, oh, you know, kind of sneering at it a bit. So yeah, I don't know if we see Steve Levy anymore, but I did wonder if he was named so because of Zachary, because of his conspiracy theorist mindset.
Who knows?
As yeah, the former Chuck / Shazam has got increasingly weird. Yeah, God. With him and Adam Baldwin, it does feel like fewer and fewer of the cast of Chuck are actually good eggs. You know, hopefully Yvonne Strahovski is still all right. but yes. Yeah, I liked the conspiracy theories of like, yeah, Wolf 359 was a conspiracy. It's, oh God. I mean, no, but I can see how people would entirely think.
Yeah, it is somehow comforting to know that even in the post-scarcity universe of Star Trek, there are still fucking morons.
Yes, yeah, because this guy is a fucking moron. Yes, he's right this one time.
He would definitely be listening to Space Alex Jones.
Yeah, yeah. What species would Space Alex Jones be?
A Ferengi, clearly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Same. Space Joe Rogan would be a Pakled.
Oh, God. I mean, he's got the look
and
the style for it, so yeah. Terrifying. Right, yeah. But yeah, this was a nice episode at showing how the group have grown, but, you know, it's not always going to be a positive thing with that.
No.
Like, you know, yeah, they're living their lives, and that's nice, and it's good, and they are making friends, which, frankly, having seen them in season one, is a surprise. But yeah, it's one of those things with this show where I am so pleased characters got to develop.
Yes. And
because this kind of cartoon, you wouldn't expect that.
Again, you know, my fears with this would be a much more Rick and Morty type show.
Yep.
Speaking of other cartoons which have done the fake clip episode.
Yes. And yeah, with moments like the conspiracy theorists, like Rutherford's pregnancy, Asif horrendously losing his leg as he ages with it broken, healing wrong rapidly, and eventually just rotting and falling off. It's like, this is grosser than I expect for a Star Trek, but, you know, it fits the tone and luckily doesn't go full Rick and Morty with it.
Thank God for Tendi, who is a ray of goddamn sunshine.
As always, yes. Yeah, and that was a nice little moment. I think it was after the second time that she was told no about her anecdote. It's like, yep, yeah, of course, this is going to be the thing that in some way saves the day.
Yep.
Which, yeah, by appealing to the heart of the sentient moss.
So have you ever worked a shift job?
Not anything other than the kindest shifts. My old work was a phone line that either started at 8:45 till 4:45, 9 till 5, or 9:30 till 5:30. So I've never had weird shifts.
Okay, so you've never had that, like, you've never had the weird friendship with the person who only ever see as they're leaving.
No. I think my brother did a bit when he was at Sainsbury's doing trolley boy work, but I've never had that kind of I'm clocking out, they're clocking in sort of thing.
Yeah, it's weird.
It must be. Do you get this kind of fake enmity, or is it just you make up stuff about them?
Well, I just tend to make up stuff about people, because it's much more fun that way to say, like, that guy, you know, once emasculated a donkey. There tend to be rivalries between opening shifts and closing shifts at Starbucks. Because the opening shifts will be complaining about the fact closing shift didn't do everything. And the closing shift would be complaining that the opening shift didn't do anything to...
Of course.
The thing is, usually the opening shift actually didn't do anything and just left all for either the mid shift or closing shift. Because, they had to wake up earlier, thus they're pissed off about everything.
God, the secret confessions for Starbucks professionals.
Yep.
Wow.
But usually, like, that kind of tends to be how it goes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I beasted season 4 so quickly, I barely remember Delta Shift. And it was that thing of, are these just one-offs? I think they appear more than this.
I think Delta Shift keep turning up regularly. They're kind of like the comedic, dark counterparts of our heroes.
Yeah. Yeah, in a way, that kind of, the way that we occasionally see the lower decks people in other things. And yeah, now we get to see this lot. Okay.
Yeah. And it makes a good point. Like, you know, you have the whole Nightcrow and a starship who never seem to encounter anything exciting.
Yeah. Well, that we know of. One of the things, some of the modern treks like Lower Decks and Prodigy have I forget now, like some of them have shown, is that, yeah, it's just, this is just Starfleet.
Yeah.
You know, any of this, any of these lives and this weird stuff. It was interesting as well, being being animated, seeing the amount of core cast that were repurposed as well as characters because of the amount of different roles they had. So, like, Jerry O'Connell playing the carnivorous moths.
Yep, and you can tell. And when you watch this with Rihanna, she... The baby Graflax, very adorable. Not as adorable as the Moopsie.
No, no. Probably not as deadly as the Moopsie.
No. I mean, that thing, they could burrow through rock pretty quickly. Not as dangerous as a horse, but there we go.
No. No, we've got a scale, I guess, for that. But yeah, this was an entertaining time. I enjoyed it, and yeah, I realized, though, as I was watching this, the amount people go on about how Star Trek reuses caves. We have watched three episodes with three different cave sets, because this one's animated, and the original series Planet Hell and the Next Generation onwards Planet Hells were different sets. So while they do get reused a lot, not in this episode of Casual Trek.
No. I mean, usually, like, it's like, it's like the joke about quarries in Doctor Who. Like, they don't go to quarries, well, they do go to quarries, but they don't go to quarries that off as insanely often.
Yeah, it's not every single episode. Sometimes they shake it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, although I did like that all of the caves in the caves episode of Lower Decks were pretty consistently drawn.
Yep.
As well. Like, some had some different bits and pieces, but as a whole, the geography was consistent between them, which is something they didn't need to do at all. And I like that they did.
They had the stairs. They had the naturally forming stairs. I like that line.
Yes. Yeah. So that was good fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was tempting to put this with the actual Clips episode, which I still need to find anything to pair that with. But
I think there's
caves was too fun.
Yeah, like you know what? I think that episode's gonna be bad, but it's still not gonna be as bad as Section 31.
No,
I mean,
God, no.
I mean, I don't think Star Trek has that many clip episodes. I think it's just like the one, this one.
Yeah, just that one TNG one. And then, yeah, this kind of fake clip episode. So, yeah, we'll see if any of the new things bring up anything like this.
Okay, so where is this going on the big list?
Oh, I'm having to scroll back up from where we put that final mission. Okay, let's see. So, we have, around the midpoint, there is Where Pleasant Fountains Lie, with the LARP ship, and of course the wonderful Jeffrey Combs.
Oh, that one's so much better.
It is.
Okay. Hey, Genesis, Buckley's a spider. Not seen this one pop up. We've not seen this one pop up in a while, but we refer to it a lot because, as we know, Worf definitely killed Nata guy.
Yeah, and that's place number 77 on the list. Oh God, this.
That was episode 19, gosh.
Oh, yeah, that's really difficult. This is definitely funnier than Genesis, but both have some wonderful moments and some body horror.
Okay, so I'm looking at number 78, which is Observation Effect.
Ooh. Oh, God, that was...
Like, that's a good Enterprise one as well.
It is. I was just marveling to myself, going, oh, that's a good one. And it's Enterprise. Yeah, there are good Enterprise episodes, people. That's what, after 65 episodes, we can tell you now. Definitively, there are some good ones.
Okay, all right. At number 82, we have The Empath with... Shatner's slow-mo and McCoy just knocking everyone out so he can sacrifice his life for the good of the trio.
Okay, I like the Amdram. I think this is better than that.
No, Whom's Gods Destroy is the Amdram.
I mean, both have an amount of it. It's more a performance piece, I guess.
Yeah, it's not as...
in a kind of blank set.
It's not as Amdram as Plato's Stepchildren.
Oh, God. Oh, God, Plato's Stepchildren. Yeah, okay. I think it's better than The Empath. I don't know with Whom Gods Destroy, because, like, yeah, Garth of Izar is so much fun. He's so wacky, him and his band.
Alright, I am good with that, this being the new number 82.
Nice. Okay. That's good. Oh, Garth of Izar. Whatever happens to Garth?
Tax exile.
Yeah. It happens.
Well, you know, if you go by my Section 31 pitch, he becomes a shapeshifter for Section 31. If we go by your script, who the fuck knows?
Yeah, it's right. In my script, he wouldn't have even been referenced because the producers wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't watch Star Trek.
God. As much as I hate Section 31, God, all four of those pitches were amazing.
They were such good fun. Okay, well, with all of that, and a rare moment of complimenting our own work there, that's it for us before we suddenly realize what we've done, much like Picard once he gets better from the life-threatening injury he had.
Oh shit, Will, tell me honestly, was I nice to the boy? You were, Captain. Fuck. Very well. Bring me the boy and a slipper.
Oh no.
I'm gonna go public school on that little bitch.
God, if there's a captain that would, it would be Picard. Like, yeah, you don't want to even reference spankings at all near Kirk.
Oh yeah.
He's gonna be way too into it.
I don't know. Sisko wouldn't spank you. Sisko would just slap you in the face.
Probably. And yeah, then, you know, Janeway out the airlock.
Yeah. You know, Archer, we don't like to talk about the episode of Quantum Leap where Sam Beckett leaps into a dominatrix. That didn't actually happen, but sometimes I wish it did.
It would have been an experience for everyone involved.
Because, you know, Al would have been into it.
God, definitely. Anyway, while we all have that mental image, what are we doing next time, Mars?
Well, next time, speaking of Sisko, we're going back to Deep Space Nine for a all Deep Space Nine episode as we tackle the first three episodes of Season 2 of Deep Space Nine, which was a loosely fitting three-part storyline.
Yeah, looking forward to seeing how that works. And like our Enterprise three-parter, whether it's something we assess individually or all together, which I guess we'll only find out once we
when we do it.
Yeah, cool. Well, until then, where can the good folks find us?
Well, they can find me on my Blue Sky at milesreedliberta.bsky.social. They can find us, the show, on Blue Sky at casualtrek.bsky.social, or you can find me on my blog at mareedlibato.wordpress.com.
Yes, and for me, I'm also on Blue Sky at skychark.bsky.social. I am on Faked Tales, once again, talking about 2000 AD, and Who Dares Roles, talk about role-playing games, and depending on when this comes out, enjoying a nice board game convention with some friends. And with that, go do a Starfleet. And, maybe stay out of the caves.
But Charlie, we're trapped in a cave.
Oh no.
We've been trapped in a cave a whole time.
Is there some kind of hallucination induced by being trapped in a cave with reduced oxygen, or maybe weird pollen or spores or something?
No, you started licking the moss almost immediately. We weren't even trapped in the cave. It was your licking the hallucinogenic space moss that caused the cave-in.
Look, you've got to try. You got to try the space boss.
You didn't know. Okay, I'll give you credit. You didn't know it was a load-bearing moss. I didn't even know that load-bearing moss could exist. But my God, you kept calling yourself Doug Ramsay, king of the Technarch people, and then you ate one of your boots.
Okay, as long as the boot wasn't Warlock, that's all right.
No, the boot wasn't Warlock. And then you just started calling yourself Adam X the Extreme.
I wondered why I've got this baseball cap on backwards.
I mean, yeah. And then you grew hair.
Right, I'm going back for some moss.
No, Charlie, no! It's load-bearing moss!
Yes!
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and Tie podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Lobato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Edited by the hosts and by Rihanna Reed Lobato. Star Trek is owned by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.